This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. It's the only show that takes you to the very deepest, the very darkest, and the very most dangerous corners of the universe. I don't know if that's a sentence, but we'll roll with it. It's where we learn about all the secret stuff that's hidden away. Now, this week, we're chatting to the author and scientist Millie Marotta, all about her brand new book, which looks at some of the most amazing and endangered species on the planet. We'll also talk about one of the most dangerous plants that's out there in the wild. Not too wild either. There might be some of this in your back garden right now. I'm being serious with that. You'll find out more in a sec. We'll also hear about a brand new planet that scientists think may hold alien life. And I'll answer some of your questions. Today, they're about the sun and hearts. It's all on the way. First, let's catch up with our favourite inventing genius. He'll tell us how some things are made. This is Sir Sidney McSprocket.
How's it made?
Oh, hello. Sir Sidney McSprocket here. I've been in action capturing facts all about manufacturing. It's for this rather splendid stipendiary compendium I'm compiling. You just ask it how something is made, and it'll oblige with a fulsome explanation. Like this. How are toothbrushes made? Oh, doesn't look quite as simple as they look. Toothbrushes are made of plastic, so that's where the process begins.
Step one.
Tiny granules of plastic are loaded into a huge steel pan called a vat to be melted to make a plastic dough.
Step two.
The dough is then molded by a machine into the shape of the handle, with holes at one end for the bristles. Sometimes different colours of plastic are used, and rubber may be molded onto the plastic to help you keep the grip.
Step three.
The handles are then sorted so they're all facing the same way with their holes upwards ready for their bristles.
Step four.
The bristles are made from long strands of nylon, which is another type of plastic that can be pulled into very thin fibres. A machine cuts the bristles to the right length and puts them down to ensure they're all equal.
Step five.
The bristles are folded in half and poked into each hole. It's a process that's done so quickly that many hundreds of holes are filled every minute. The tiny staple is pushed over the fold and into the base of the brush so that the bristles won't come out in your mouth. Oh, that wouldn't taste very nice.
Step six.
When they're all in place, the bristles are trimmed into shape and the toothbrushes are then ready to be placed in their packets. Now, whilst people have cleaned their teeth for many, many years, the toothbrush itself only came into being around 500 years ago. It's thought that the Chinese made the very first ones, using bone or bamboo for the handles and bristles from a boar's back. Oh, not sure I'd like to pop one of those into my mouth. Now, I must get on, but come back soon and find out more about manufacturing with my splendid stipendiary compendium.
How's it made? With support from the Royal Commission for the 1851 exhibition. Find out more at funkidslive.com.
Question time on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the part of the show where you can send in your sciencey questions, something that's rattling around your brain that you simply need to know the answer to. You can fire it over to me by leaving it as a review on Apple Podcasts for the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Then I'll see it and I'll do all the legwork, all the dirty stuff to try and find out the answer for you. This is from Mia, who took her 11 plus exams to get into high school the other day, and she burst a blood vessel in her eye. That's really not what you want at the start of an exam, is it? Especially when you're nervous and everything and you've prepared for so long anyway. So that's bad news. But the plus side of it is that it has given Mia a question for me, because she wants to know how heart does beat blood all around the body. You see the connection? Well, Mia, it's because the heart has got two sides to it, and it needs to pump oxygenated blood around your body so it can give oxygen to parts that are useful to all your limbs, to all your other organs. So what happens is blood rushes into one half of the heart, where it gets pushed around the lungs. When it's in the lungs, it collects all the oxygen, and that makes it red. Then it goes into the other half of the heart, which pumps it all around the body to deliver the oxygen before it comes back to the other half of the heart to be re-oxygenated. This is a constant process of it being sent all around your body in a kind of figure eight flow, where it goes around your body, back to be oxygenated, back around your body again. It's constantly moving. Now, the heart is made to pump by tiny actual electrical impulses. It keeps the whole thing ticking over. And scientists think that your heart beats 100,000 times a day. There's a lot of work going on inside there. Thank you so much for the question, Mia. And this is from Mustafa, who asks, how many suns are there? Which is the biggest? Which is the hottest? Now, our sun, Mustafa, it's really just a big star. And there are loads of other much bigger stars that are out there around the universe. And the universe is constantly expanding, constantly getting bigger. More stars are constantly being made. So there are way too many to count, really. The largest star that we know of is called VY Canis Majoris, which is between 3,900 and 5,000 light years away. This star is so big that if it was our sun, it would go out from the middle and end up being further into the solar system than Jupiter is. Our sun would fit inside this one 2,100 times. They think it's around 3,000 Kelvin hot. But other stars get up to 25,000 Kelvin. So it's the biggest one we know of, but it certainly isn't the hottest. Mustafa, thank you so much for the question. If you've got something sciencey that you need answered on the show, you need to leave it for me as a review for the Fun Kids Science Weekly over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. This week's guest is going to tell us all about those creatures all around the world that we need to work just a little bit harder to saving. She's written a book. It's called A Wild Child's Guide to Endangered Animals. It's Millie Marotta. Hey, Millie.
Hello.
Thanks so much for joining us. I think we should start by just trying to define what an endangered animal is. How many do there need to be for a species to be classed as endangered?
Well, I think it's less about how many there actually are, because often that can be a number that varies quite a bit from source to source. And I think it's more to do with how quickly their numbers are declining and how likely they are to disappear from the planet within a certain amount of time. So some species might have tens of thousands of individuals left, whereas others might only have 100, but they could equally be described as being at risk of extinction or of being endangered. So it depends sort of on a lot of other things rather than just how many are left.
Now, you've made this guidebook and it's full of different animals that are endangered. What was your protocol, really? What did a creature need to be for it to make it into your book?
Well, my book focuses on those animals, actually, that are perhaps less well known. So we all know about the tigers and the gorillas and the pandas, and rightly so. Those animals deserve to be talked about and discussed. But I specifically wanted in my book to look at those creatures that we don't often hear about and that many of us might actually never have heard of before, or some of the creatures in the book are animals that we're quite familiar with, but might not have realised that they are actually endangered. So that was my sort of approach with my book, was to give those animals that we don't hear about very often a bit of time in under the spotlight.
And they're absolutely, like, some of the pictures in here and the creatures that you've talked about are truly spectacular. Let's just run through a few of these. You talk about the shoebill in the book. Can you tell us a bit more about why such a powerful bird like that is facing extinction?
Well, for the shoebill, it's all to do with the destruction of their habitat. And it is a truly remarkable bird. It's quite bizarre. I don't know if many of your listeners will have heard about the shoebill, but I remember seeing it quite a long time ago on a nature documentary and just being absolutely fascinated by this prehistoric looking creature, which is just so clearly sort of the link between birds and dinosaurs, if you like. It's just quite a bizarre creature. And it's sort of really, really has really menacing attributes to it, but also at the same time is really quite endearing and comical. And so writing about it in the book, I sort of wanted to talk about those things, as well as how obviously it is at risk of becoming extinct. And in the back of the book, I explain in a bit more detail about why specifically it is becoming a creature that needs our help.
Also, I'm always fascinated by the seahorse, because male seahorses, we know, do something which I don't think is mirrored across any other animal. They carry the young. Can you tell us a bit more about why they do that?
Yeah, so they are quite unique in that the male seahorse is the one who becomes pregnant rather than the females. So, I mean, to be very sort of technical about it, the female deposits her eggs into a little pouch found towards the bottom of the male's belly, which is called the brood pouch. And that's where the eggs are fertilised, and he keeps them there nice and safe and nourished while they develop. And then after only about 2 or 3 weeks, literally hundreds of miniature, perfectly formed seahorses burst out into the water. And these babies are tiny. They're like 1 centimetre long. And they are then immediately independent of their parents and drift away at the mercy of the ocean currents.
And it's not just the creatures that you talk about in so much detail. It's also parts of the world. Tell us a bit more about New Zealand, because New Zealand, we know it to have creatures, flora, fauna that you won't find really anywhere else on the planet. But also it's home to an incredible amount of flightless birds. Can you tell us a bit more about this, Millie?
Yeah, it is. New Zealand has many, many unique animals, many of which are flightless birds. We've got penguins, obviously, which are flightless birds. One of the flightless birds that I featured in A Wild Child's Guide to Endangered Animals is called the South Island Takahe. And what's remarkable about the South Island Takahe is that it was actually already thought to be extinct at one point, and it was sort of rediscovered, if you like. It sort of came back from the dead, I suppose, if you like, in a way. And there's quite an extensive program underway to try and bolster the numbers of wild South Island takahes. But yeah, the thing with the danger for the flightless birds in New Zealand is largely ground predators that were introduced. We're talking about rats and cats who will take the young, eat the eggs, pluck chicks out of nests. Obviously, these poor birds can't fly away from these types of dangers. So that has been a huge problem for them, and one of the main causes for numbers dwindling so badly.
Now, if you hadn't grown up in an area so full of wildlife, do you think that you'd have cared about animals as much, or is it are these things directly linked?
No, I think I would have. I mean, I was lucky enough that I grew up with wilderness all around me, and we had plenty of space, and so I was able and allowed to keep many, many pets. And certainly that sort of reinforced a love and a passion for animals and the natural world. But I think it's such an inherent thing for me, as it is for so many others, and certainly as I was a child, I think I would have been just as interested and fascinated had that not been the case.
Amazing. The book is called A Wild Child's Guide to Endangered Animals. Millie Marotta, thank you so much for telling us all about it.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
This week's Dangerous Dan is about one of the most deadly plants in the world. It goes by many names, and to be honest, none of them are that nice. You might know it as Monk's Hood, or Blue Rockets, or Devil's Helmet, or Queen of Poisons, or Wolf's Bane, or its actual name, Aconitum. Now, they've got a long, drooping flower. Kind of looks like a helmet. And it can be a range of colours from blue to dark purple. Some Aconitum buds are even yellow. And it's found surprisingly commonly throughout the wild, even all around forests of the UK. Sometimes you can find a wolf's bane or a devil's helmet. Now, it holds two toxins in there. There's aconitine and mesaconitine, which, if they're eaten, it can slow your heart right down. The aconitine lowers your blood rate and it causes wicked stomach pains, and it can even kill you. Now, it's said to taste absolutely awful, so it's pretty easy to steer clear of eating it, which is half the issue. The problem is that just brushing against aconitum, it could be enough. The poison that it holds can get through your skin, particularly if you've got a cut or a graze, it can seep through that way. It causes places across your body to get numb, there's nausea, there's vomiting, it becomes hard to breathe. Now, throughout history, wolf's bane has been used as the tip of poison arrows. And have a listen to this, its name, wolf's bane, well, it's even said that werewolves are scared of it. That's how deadly and that's how dangerous Aconitum really is. It's time to catch up with another one of our Science Weekly geniuses right now, one of the experts that you can only really hear on this show. This one knows all about the climate, and her name's Marina Ventura.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers.
Now, we all like talking about the weather. In fact, people in Britain are well known for it.
The weather's quite good. It's quite hot and it's quite sunny.
Windy and very cold.
A bit rainy.
Freezing.
About a bit sunny.
Very windy. All of the leaves are falling off the trees.
Talking about the weather is one of the ways we start conversations, especially with people we don't know. One of the reasons for this is because it's something we have in common with everyone around us. If it's a rainy day and I get soaked in a downpour, you might have got wet too. And if it's freezing cold, then you're probably feeling it as well. And weather is a topic that everyone has an opinion about. Maybe it's chillier than it was yesterday. Perhaps you didn't expect to need a coat because you thought it was going to be a bit warmer. Not knowing quite what to expect means it's often surprising. That's why people like to read, listen to, or watch weather forecasts every day to help make sure they've got the right clothes on.
And with rain heading down south, tomorrow is set to be wet, so don't forget your umbrella.
After all, no one likes getting soaked. But weather's quite a strange thing. Even if it's cold and wet on one day, the next day can be very different. And not everyone gets the same weather, even when they're in the same country.
Schools in the north of England will be shut today due to heavy snow. But in the Midlands, there's no snow, so schools are open as usual. Sorry, kids.
So as you can see, weather is constantly changing, which is probably why it's so interesting. As we've seen, weather forecasts help us to know what to expect, but even without them, we have a feeling about what the weather should be like at different times of the year. We expect it to be cold in winter and warmer in summer. Have you ever wondered why this is? Let's find out. Let's ask MapApp. He's great at explaining things.
It's all to do with climate. There's a saying, weather is what you get and climate is what you expect. And that's a great way to remember the difference. Weather describes what the conditions are like at a particular time and place, whilst climate is what the weather is generally like at that time of year. Here in the UK, winters are generally mild and summers, well, they don't get too hot. We have what's called a temperate climate.
So how do they figure out what the climate is?
Scientists constantly take measurements of the weather, things like temperature and rainfall, and they do this over many years. This gives them a lot of information and helps them to see patterns. These patterns help describe the climate.
Most people will never have seen those measurements, but we still know that our winters are usually cold. How come?
During everyone's lifetimes, people learn about the patterns in weather. And as you've described, because weather is a popular topic of conversation, these ideas have always been shared. What is interesting is that just like the weather, those patterns that make up our climate can gradually change too. And because scientists keep track of weather measurements from the past, they can spot these slow changes.
Fascinating, Mappy. Next time, we'll explore how climates differ in different parts of the world. See you then.
Marina Ventura's Climate Explorers, supported by the Natural Environment Research Council, the science of the natural world. Find out more at funkidslive.com/marina.
Right, let's get this week's science that's been in your news. Big news to start us off. Astronomers have for the first time discovered water in the atmosphere of a planet on a potentially habitable planet. It's called, rather catchily, K2-18b, and it makes it a candidate for alien life. Within 10 years, new telescopes hopefully will be able to tell whether it also contains gases that could be made by living organisms, which is another clue of life. It's over twice the size of Earth, and it's 650 million miles away. That's 111 light years from Earth, a long time to get there. Also, an amateur astronomer has discovered a comet that could come from outside the solar system. At the moment, it's about 450 million kilometres from the sun. Its orbit is wildly unpredictable, though, so scientists are going to keep a close eye on it. And finally, an historic global agreement aimed at halting deforestation has failed, according to a recent report. An assessment of the New York Declaration on Forests says that it failed to deliver key promises. It was meant to halve deforestation levels by 2020, and it's not even come close. And that is the end of this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. If you've enjoyed any of the geniuses that you've heard this week, all the experts that we have on with their own little special segments, you can actually hear loads more of them whenever you like. And there are tons more for you to catch up on. They're all on the Apple Podcast Store. They're on Spotify. You can get them on the Fun Kids app and have a listen at funkidslive.com. And while you're on the Apple Podcast Store, by the way, if that's how you do listen to this show, it's the best way for you to leave a science question for me to answer for you. Go to the review page, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly. At the bottom, there's a comment box. That's where you leave your question. Also, drop your name so I know who to say hello to. And leave us 5 stars as well, because that really helps me see it. I'll be back again with you next week. In the meantime, maybe you can catch me on Fun Kids. We're a children's radio station across the UK. You can find us on your DAB digital radio. We're on the free Fun Kids app. You can ask your smart speaker to play us. Wake it up with a magic word, then say, play Fun Kids. And you can also get us at funkidslive.com.